session number 19106, Reel 3.
Roger, call it Reel 3. You were telling me about the raid on Rumry Island when your aircraft nearly ran out of fuel. Could you tell me that story again?
Well, we needed long-range tanks, which you disposed of, you dropped off, and you also had an emergency tank, which you put on if you you kept on turning from one tank to another. I forget just what the system was, but we had several tanks, I remember, and you had to switch from one to another as you were flying. And coming back, I was flying rather low over Mong Dor, and suddenly the engine stopped, which meant you had to turn onto the emergency tank pretty smartly if you wanted to remain airborne. I did this, fortunately, and the engine came to life again. Gave me a bit of a shock, I can tell you. However, all was well.
So how long were you at Brighton and Hove?
About 7 months, I think, mostly at Hove. And during that time, there was the emergency up at Kohima. And so I took B flight up to the Imphal Valley, where we were stationed for, I suppose, about 2 months, in case there were any Japanese tanks involved. There wouldn't have been, I suppose, many Japanese tanks at Kohima, but they were also attacking from the south, coming up through Bishnupur from Tidim, Tidim and what was the other place? Kalewa. And so generally speaking, we spent quite a time just waiting for trouble, but the Japanese tanks actually didn't turn up, so we just did ordinary reconnaissance and attacked whatever we were told to attack, which was mostly very similar to being down in Arakan and taking on targets the army wanted us to attack.
And what form did those targets take? Was it pillboxes or bunkers?
Well, it was mostly map references, to tell you the truth. I did on one occasion go down what was known as Death Valley. And this was a valley which went from, I think, Tidim down to Kalewa, and it was mosquito-ridden. And I can remember catching a couple of lorries there that had in it some Indian troops, actually, who were on the Japanese side. They were the Indian deserters, or...
The Indian National Army.
Indian National Army, that was it, yes, the Indian National Army. There was this chap, this Bengali, I forget his name, who was very anti-British and lived in Tokyo, and he recruited them. At all events, by and large, it was much the same as flying over Kohima, of course. We didn't actually involve ourselves in any ground attacks there, because I think mostly the Hurry Bomber squadrons were involved there. We were at Palel, that was the name of the airdrome we operated from, in the south of the Imphal Valley.
Were there any specific operations that you remember that weren't map references but were in support of ground troops at all?
Not really, no. I remember the Japanese got onto the aerodrome one night and started, they didn't do any damage to the Hurricanes, but they put grenades in two or three cockpits of Spitfires that happened to be there. And it took some Gurkha troops in the at daylight to sort them out, because they had not returned to the jungle. They got into onto a little hillock in the middle of the airfield, and they were surrounded, so they all committed harakiri, which was the usual thing, I suppose, in those days.
In that situation, did you have specific troops allotted to you for airfield protection?
Well, we actually had the RAF regiment to do that, but I suppose they were not, they were defensive troops rather than offensive, and so when you got a situation like this with very aggressive Japanese infiltrators, you've got to have somebody like the Gurkhas really to go in and terrify them, which happened.
Did you carry any personal sidearms?
Oh, always, yes. I carried an automatic, actually, not a revolver, an automatic, which apparently you wanted to throw away if you were shot down and captured, because the Japanese didn't approve of automatics. They thought that they were they themselves used a lot of 22s, didn't they? Very small caliber. They didn't like these .5s in the automatics. They thought they were did too much damage. I also carried a Panga, because when I was shot down in Arakan attacking a Japanese airfield, I was shot down in the Caladan Valley, about several miles behind the lines, and I told the other members of the flight to go home, and I landed where I thought, and I was fortunately right, there was a very forward African patrol of West Africans, Nigerian troops. And I landed on a hillside, and sure enough, they came out of the trees, black men, and not yellow chaps. And I, as a memento, they all carried Pangas, these chaps, you see, which is, I've got the Panga in the garage. I use it still, and for chopping wood and that. And they gave me this as a memento. They all had them for cutting their way through the jungle. So I always carried this Panga there afterwards. Whenever I went on ops, I always had my Panga, because I thought it'd be a handy thing if one did come down in the jungle itself. But on this occasion, I landed on a fairly bare hillside, wheels up. And
had you been hit by ground fire?
Evidently, yes, attacking. We were sent at dawn to attack what was said to be a Japanese general, had arrived at this aerodrome, and his aircraft was on the runway, you see, or near the runway, and we were to go and shoot it up. In actual fact, it was a Japanese trick. It was a dummy, and they were waiting for us, and we went in at dawn, literally, and it wasn't a surprise at all. They surprised us. So I was leading and I got hit, and the other chaps peeled off and went home, because, I mean, it didn't exist. There was no target. It was a dummy.
How did you realise you were hit?
Well, the engine started to falter, and I went on, I suppose, for about 10 miles, and stop, start, and a certain amount of glycol, coolant smoke, and I realised that I wasn't going to get back. I got about 80 miles to fly back, and I couldn't see it happening. So if I went over the trees, the jungle, I didn't want to land, come down into trees, I would go to the Caladan Valley, which was a bit further on, where I knew there were some bare hillsides, or relatively bare hillsides, and I also thought that Africans were still around there. I think it was Tudiv, West African Tudiv. I think they were the second Div.
Nigeria.
82nd, was it? Yeah, 82nd. Yes, not Tudiv. 82nd. That was right. 82nd. Nigerians. They were houses, anyway. They were Muslims. They were a good lot. They had the British officers, of course. And then they arranged for an L5, which the American aeroplane. And there was this rather chap who flew in to a prepared strip, which the Africans made from time to time, and he picked up their wounded. And he came in and he picked me up and took me back to the squadron. So in actual fact, I got back to the squadron in a very short time. I mean, we did a dawn raid, and I was shot down, and I got taken back to the squadron by nightfall, before nightfall. So I was lucky. I mean, I must admit, it was the luckiest thing could possibly go. I didn't get a scratch.
You mentioned earlier on that you had another landing in the sea.
That was during monsoon, because we went on flying back in Arakan again. This is the monsoon, of course, arrived and it curtailed our activities more and more and more, until one day we went out on an op, and I think there were six of us. I know the CO was leading, and we went looking for a target, but we never got there. It was quite impossible because the cloud came right down, right onto the deck, and we were flying in the cloud. You could hardly see each other, let alone see any chance of seeing the coast or target. And I remember he called us up and said, "We've got to go back, you know, it's hopeless." And we went back and we got rather separated, and I discovered I was on the coast, and I'd got a cliff on my right wing, and I was going up, and I thought, well, how am I going to get over? So I thought, well, there are plenty of hurricanes now in the pipeline, but there's only one of me, and I landed in the sea, in the shallow sea, and I happened to land in a village, and the headman and another chap came out and pulled me out and dried my clothes and sent a message somewhere or other, I don't know. Anyway, I got picked up.
How far away were you from, was it Brighton or Hove you were based at the time?
No, it was during the monsoon. We had to give up both Brighton and Hove, and we went back up nearer to Chittagong. It was fair way. This particular place was down on the Naaf Peninsula, which was south of Hove, quite a bit south, but it was far, miles up to where we were. Chiringi, I think it was the place we were, or Chiringa. Chiringa was the place near to Chittagong, Chiringa. Yes, it was a tarmac strip, just one strip. And finally, the monsoon was such we gave up and went back to India for a rest at Madras, St. Thomas's Mouth. We flew back.
So through that period of your starting operations, apart from the 2 month period you were in Fal, you were based in the Arakan.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then we went to rest at Madras and Trichinopoly, and then finally back to Imphal. The squadron went up to Imphal in December 43. 43, yes, 43. Yes, we are still in 43, aren't we? Yes. And, 44. And then I was time expired. I did 3 years, and I'd done about 3.5 by then. And in January 45, I went down with malaria up at Imphal. We were back in the Imphal Valley by then, and I was posted home and came went over to Bombay and was put into a hospital in the whole way home. I got various things. I had malaria 5 times by then, and I also got jungle sores. And so I spent the trip home in bed, actually, funnily enough. And when we landed at Glasgow, I was put into hospital for about a month.
Did you have any precautions to take against malaria?
Well, we weren't allowed to. Air crew were not allowed to take atabrine or mepoquine. The squadron, all the ground crew, took it, and they were always yellow Japanese. But the pilots were considered to be at risk if they did this. If you were over a certain altitude, I think it was 5,000 or 6,000, they thought you would get dizzy or something. There was something you'd pass out. I don't know what it was, but anyway, we were not allowed to take atabrine, was German, or mepoquine, which was British, and under no circumstances, so that we just had to put up with it. If we got malaria, we got malaria. We couldn't fly anyway.
And the jungle sores, how did you contract those?
I don't know whether it was diet or what it was, but you got them under your arms. I got them under both my arms. I had to have them cut.
Well, what form did they take?
Well, like a ulcer or large boil, that sort of thing, you know. You could get worse things than that. You'd get dengue, you'd get typhoid, but we didn't. I mean, we were inoculated against a great many things. Even the plague we were inoculated against.
While you were operating in Burma, you mentioned attacking Japanese positions. Did you ever have the opportunity to see on the ground any damage that you'd inflicted on the positions?
Not really. We were told afterwards that, like the Punjabis, that we'd done a good job. More, I suppose, by luck than judgment, really, because if you had a map reference, you fired almost in the dark very often.
So you would fly to the map reference and try and identify a target on that reference?
Try, yes.
But often there wouldn't be...
Well, no, the Japanese were extremely good at camouflaging. And they, except perhaps in a place like Kohima, where all the trees were shot to bits, I think they were expert. Until, of course, the war moved down to Mandalay, but of course I'd come home by then. The squadron went on to the bitter end. The various other pilots joined. And I am in touch with those that stayed on or joined. And so I know a bit about it, but, I mean, for instance, the occasion when the chap who took over my flight when I came home, he was the one who found the tanks, the Japanese tanks, which I wrote a poem about. He's a chap from Trinidad. And
you never yourself actually saw any Japanese tanks?
I never saw Japanese tanks, no, not... No, I didn't. There were supposed to be some near Bishnupur, but we look for them, we never find them.
And what happened when the Trinidadian pilot found the tanks?
I say Trinidad, and he lives in Trinidad now, but he actually born and bred in Jamaica, a Scotsman actually called Jim Farquharson. And he saw them camouflaged, but not evidently quite well enough camouflaged, and he had an eagle eye anyway, and so he shot them up. And they came out, and so he went and got the squadron, and the whole squadron gave them hell. I think they got about 14 tanks that day, and he got a DFC for being clever, which he was. And fortunately, after the war, he became a BOAC pilot, and he got this dreadful thing. This what was it that made you paralyzed? Infantile paralysis. He landed in Montego Bay in Jamaica one day, and he was a Viscount captain by then, and he's been crippled ever since. He's been on crutches ever since. That was in 1953 or 1954, I think. And I see him from time to time. He's coming over in September. He's got a flat in Cheltenham. He married an English girl, and she's got family over here, so he comes over once a year if he can. But he is, he's been on crutches for 50 years.
And what were your attitudes to serving in Burma?
Well, you reminisce about it, you probably think it was nicer now than it was at the time. But it was the war, and you had a job to do, you pressed on. Reminiscent, you remember the good parts and none of the bad, no doubt.
What was your opinion of the Japanese?
Well, I didn't like the Japanese one bit. We just had a very low opinion of the Japanese, quite honestly.
Was there a reason for that?
Well, there were occasions. For instance, one of our pilots who'd been shooting up one of their positions landed, and some Japanese came out and cut his head off. Just like that. I mean, this was seen by other members of the squadron.
Did that affect your attitude to flying at all?
I don't think so, no. You felt you've got to get your own back. This is war, isn't it? It's a sort of revengeful attitude, but that's how you win wars, by getting on top of the other side, eventually.
And did you have any contact with the Burmese civilians?
In Arakan, we had a lot of Muslims, and the Arakanese were on our side. We didn't meet Burmese. I suppose eventually the squadron got into the plains and down towards Mandalay they met Burmese, but we got the impression the Burmese were not our friends. Up at Imphal, the Nagas were definitely being clan tribesmen. They were on our side again, as were the Karens and Shan states. They were all a different thing. The Burmese didn't seem to be our friends somehow or other, the impression I got, but I never actually remember meeting Burmese. The villager, for instance, who rescued me after I landed in the sea, they were Muslims. They were. I think they've probably been all cleared out now by the Burmese. But the Burmese didn't like the Muslims, and the Muslims evidently didn't like the Burmese.